from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, yesterday President Obama announced that he would order the creation of the world's largest marine sanctuary in the South Central Pacific Ocean.
I'm going to use my authority as president to protect some of our most precious marine landscapes, just like we do for mountains and rivers and forests.
The president's move underscored the many growing threats to marine ecosystems, including the crisis of ocean acidification. It's caused by increasing levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and it has many people concerned, including the local seafood industry, which is already seeing its effects. This hour on Forum, ocean acidification and what can be done about it, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Increases in atmospheric carbon dioxide emissions, primarily caused by the burning of fossil fuels as well as other pollutants, have contributed to a major problem of acidification of the oceans, a threat to ecology, coastal communities, and industries, including commercial and recreational fishing. Oceans worldwide are 30% more acidic since the Industrial Revolution, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says the oceans could become 150 times more acidic by century's end. According to the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, harm to coral reefs alone could total $870 billion annually in the next 8 decades. And another study concludes that the United States mollusk shellfish industry could lose hundreds of millions of dollars by 2060. Earlier this week, the Department of State hosted a 2-day global summit on problems facing the ocean, including acidification. And yesterday, President Obama proposed a vast expansion of Pacific Ocean sanctuaries. Here in California, as of 2008, some 75% of Californians live in coastal communities, and the ocean economy accounted for $39 billion and at least 434,000 jobs. This opening Forum Hour, we want to discuss ocean acidification, what is being proposed as action to deter it, and the president's latest ocean proposal. I want to go first to Washington and welcome Jared Huffman, Congressman, 2nd District of California. That represents the entire North Coast from the Golden Gate Bridge to the Oregon border. And Congressman Huffman, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Let's begin by finding out what went on. You did some conferring, I believe, at UC Davis. In fact, we're going to talk to John Largier, who's here with us in studio, but did some conferring with a number of experts and researchers and business people. And what did you conclude?
We pulled a group together at the UC Davis Marine Laboratory in Bodega Bay. And it was a chance for me and others to hear the latest thinking from some of the top scientists, and John, who's joining us here, is one of them. We also heard from commercial fishermen. We heard from folks in the shellfish business, and the consensus is that we are already seeing some impacts of ocean acidification. There is every reason to believe that this is going to have far-reaching impacts to the food web, to the economy. And we need to start getting out ahead of this issue very quickly.
A lot of this has to do with changes in pH, does it not?
That's correct.
And at this point, are we talking about maybe expanding the boundaries of the Gulf of Farallones and Cordell National Marine Sanctuaries off of the Marin Coast?
We hope that's going to happen very soon. And that is one piece of the response to this crisis for our oceans, is having some areas that are protected so that the other stressors, which will only exacerbate the impacts of acidification, can be managed better.
And what about funding for research?
That's part of a bill that I'm working on, and I'm happy to say it is bipartisan. We have a bill that kind of takes an XPRIZE approach to this ocean acidification issue. It leverages some additional money in a way that we hope will bring potentially many millions of dollars to bear on research and breakthroughs on ocean acidification.
Well, as I understand it, the Ocean Acidification Innovation Act, which was put together, your name is on it, and a couple of Washington congressional representatives, it's kind of like an XPRIZE competition or something along those lines.
That's right. And if we can have the same kind of success that they've had with the XPRIZE space program, that would be great. We may get some breakthrough technology, certainly some better science on this important issue. And everybody agrees that we've just got to do much more research. We've We've got a lot of questions that aren't answered yet.
Well, one of those questions that has been answered or seems to have been answered is the climate change, and carbon dioxide makes for more corrosive oceans.
Correct.
Plain fact there. So what about monitoring pH balance? I mean, you're going to do that in Tomales Bay?
Well, they're already doing it in Tomales Bay. In fact, we heard from the folks at Hog Island Oyster Company that they're moving to a real-time monitoring because there are times when this acidification problem is bad enough that they literally can't afford for their oyster seed to be exposed to that water. So they need to be able to shut it off and recirculate when the acidity is high. And so that's one example of the types of adaptation and mitigation measures that lots of folks are going to have to put in place as we deal with this.
And we are going to talk later in the hour with somebody from the oyster company up there in the north. Are you concerned about the economic effects on the north coast, or to what extent are you concerned?
Oh, hugely concerned. Basically, the way it was put by the experts at our gathering on Monday in Bodega Bay was that about everything except jellyfish have the potential to be hugely impacted by this problem. So, you know, if you like jellyfish and you think that we can maybe build a commercial fisheries for them, you shouldn't worry. But everybody else should worry. That includes the communities that have depended on commercial and recreational salmon fishing, the groundfish fleet that I have in my district. There's just an awful lot of seafood jobs and communities that depend on them, not just in my district, but throughout California.
So ultimately, you feel optimistic moving forward about what can be done or what needs to be done?
You know, I feel like there's a lot of consensus here. I don't hear anybody disputing the fact that this increasing level of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere is absorbed by the oceans, that this does have an effect on ocean acidity, that in areas like my North Coast district, where upwelling of cold water from deep areas also raises acidity, that we have the potential for a real catastrophe. So, you know, just getting everybody on board with that problem statement is important. And we'll now hopefully move forward to get even more research and information and also start talking about actions we can take.
But you do have a lot of congressional representatives up there on the Hill who, well, don't necessarily agree with you, or you also have the problems of gridlock in terms of moving forward. It's nice to hear you're optimistic, but realistically?
Well, we've got a Republican on board. Jamie Herrera Butler from the state of Washington is a co-author of this ocean acidification legislation that we're talking about. So that's a good start. We obviously have a lot more work to do, and you know the politics in Washington on climate change, Michael. It's tough right now.
Jared Huffman, Congressman, 2nd District in California, and good to have you with us, Congressman. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let me tell you who else is with us. In fact, here in studio, I mentioned John Largier, who is professor in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at UC Davis, stationed in Bodega Marine Laboratory. John, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thanks.
Also say good morning to Emily Jeffers, who's here with us as well, staff attorney in the Oceans Program in the Center for Biological Diversity. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And, John, let me begin with you, and let's begin by talking about the primary effect on this on marine life as you see it, particularly on shellfish.
Yeah, it was, as you've already covered, the increased carbon dioxide in the water is making it more acidic. And what does more acidic mean? It means more hydrogen ions. So you're shifting the balance. Actually, if you've ever been lucky enough to make wine or maintain a pool, you know that pH balance is critical into maintaining these equilibrium reactions. And in this case, it's does calcium carbonate form solid or does it dissolve into its ion form? As you shift the pH a little bit, you shift that balance and it becomes more and more difficult for animals to make these hard parts like skeletons and shells and so on. That's a fundamental issue.
Acidification also means lower oxygen too, doesn't it?
Well, it's more of a parallel effect. The lower oxygen tends to occur in the same place as acidification, which is due to too much carbon dioxide. And the background to that is if you think of photosynthesis, the growth of plant matter, it's grabbing carbon out of the water and releasing oxygen. So you are you're increasing oxygen and decreasing carbon dioxide. And then as that plant matter decays, you release carbon dioxide and you grab the oxygen out of the water. So you tend to get a lot of carbon dioxide and a little oxygen in the same places.
It's very important, and we're going to talk about this later in the hour, then, to expand marine sanctuaries, but also the research in this. I was reading an article by Zeke Grader, whom I'm sure you're familiar with,
right.
Fisherman, who speaks for the fishermen, says, got to invest in science.
Yep, that's something Zeke has been working towards for a while and much appreciated. Here I would say that scientists are scurrying to try and understand exactly which organisms are going to be impacted and exactly how the pH, the acidity of the ocean, varies, because underlying this trend is, of course, a lot of variability. The upwelling season is more acidic than the winter time. When the wind blows hard and there's an upwelling event, it's more acidic. And when the wind's not blowing, from day to night, the pH changes. So it's really extreme events. When are they going to happen and where are they going to happen? It's more acidic off Point Arena, which is a core of upwelling, than it is, say, off Drake's Bay, off Stinson Beach, where it's not so strong upwelling.
We're talking, frankly, are we not, maybe, I mean, not to sound too doomsday-ish here, but about the very survival of local shellfish companies and fishing communities.
Yeah, that I think they really are at the front. They probably don't like to be called the canary in the coal mine, because that suggests that the canary tends to die, and then you get worried. We want to get worried before this industry suffers so much. But right now they are, it's part of their management process, and I guess Terry can expand on that. It's a real problem for them.
Well, we actually have Terry Sawyer on the line. I want to go to Emily Jeffers, but Terry Sawyer is with us, and he's a co-owner of Hog Island Oyster Company. Terry, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good. Glad to have you. Can you expand on this for us and talk about what you're facing here or confronting?
Yes. Well, good morning. And so what I'm facing right now is the issue is having initially the availability of what we call seed, or the what we depend on from hatcheries up and down the West Coast in providing us. And we plant those out and we grow them all the way to market size. And what the issue is of course, if you don't have a seed to plant, you can't grow. And for us, it can affect us for up to 4 to 5 years in the future. So if we can't get it because of the pH issues that are going on, and this is what's being proved out, that they're having crashes, almost complete 100% crashes of the seed at the hatchery levels. If we can't get that, of course, we're affected for a very long time.
Again, we can't put too much emphasis, or can't put enough emphasis on this pH level, because, you know, if it drops down to, what's it, about 8.1 now, if it drops down to 7.7, they're talking about the corals being excessively endangered. What about numbers as far as you're concerned?
Well, with us, it's going to be, there's a couple of things that are going on here. One is the availability of the seed just from a hatchery that's an existing hatchery, but it's also, if our strategy is to try to do our own hatchery, which we haven't done in the past as a company. But the other is to try to manage the seed if we can. If we have an on-land upwelling system that we use to hold it, we can try to turn off the intake that supplies the water during the time of the upwelling events, which bring that lower pH water. Turn it off, well, for how long? Well, it depends on what kind of reserve water that we have and what, you know, the reserve capacity and what we can do to possibly buffer it. And that's short term. As far as trying to maintain a business, obviously we have to come up with multiple strategies on this.
And what are customers likely to see as far as the effects of all this? Higher prices, I assume?
Well, probably higher prices, but lack of availability is the bottom line.
Terry Sawyer, again, is co-owner of Hog Island Oyster Company. Terry, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Emily Jeffers, as I said, is here in studio with us. She's staff attorney in the Oceans Program with the Center for Biological Diversity. You're trying to get some of these state and federal managers to use the Clean Water Act?
We want all the tools in our toolbox to be used to address this problem, because it's not something that we're going to solve with a single stroke. So ultimately, ocean acidification is driven by carbon dioxide emissions, and that's a global problem. But on a local level, there are things that we can do to change local sources of pollution to mitigate the effects of ocean acidification. And one of those is using the Clean Water Act to identify waters that are particularly vulnerable to ocean acidification, and then devise effective management strategies to lessen those pollutants.
Well, again, talking about your toolbox, I think you filed a complaint back in October against the EPA. Can you tell us about that?
That's correct. Under the Clean Water Act, states are required every 2 years to identify all the waters in their boundaries which are not meeting water quality standards. And so all states have water quality standards for pH, and they also have narrative standards that say, you know, our ocean waters have to support shellfish rearing, they have to support fisheries. And we said that Oregon and Washington have waters right now. There are huge shellfish die-offs in the hatcheries along the coast that are not meeting water quality standards, and that they should have identified those waters as impaired so we can move forward and start effectively devising strategies to deal with a problem.
And what other things are in your legal toolbox, so to speak, at this point?
Well, anything that reduces carbon emissions is, you know, that's what we need to do. So the Clean Air Act can do that. I think ultimately the Clean Water Act can do that. We can also designate certain species that are particularly affected by ocean acidification as endangered and give them extra protection so other parallel stressors might be reduced and give them a little time to adapt to changing ocean chemistry.
Well, here in California, of course, we have emission curbs via Assembly Bill 32 and Senate Bill 375, but we also need auxiliary laws to bear on coastal management and water quality.
Agreed.
So, I mean, this is pretty much part of what you are about, is it not?
Yes, I think we need everything that we can do to solve the problem. And the problem, it's difficult to overemphasize how dire the situation is. And, you know, the rate of change that we're seeing in ocean chemistry is really unprecedented in the last, say, 300 million years in geologic history. And the closest analog we have occurred about 55 million years ago. And that rate of change was 10 times slower than what we're seeing today. And during that time, there were huge mass extinctions in the ocean, and approximately 96% of all benthic organisms went extinct. And today, scientists are saying that by the end of the century, continuing on our course, as many as a third of all marine species could go extinct. So the time to act is now. We just have to do something.
And when we're talking, let me go back to John Largier. It took about the science here, because in California, Washington, and Oregon, we're seeing a lot of evidence of dissolving shells of key species. I mean, we're talking about the whole food chain base here, aren't we?
Yeah, they're definitely, as you mentioned, the shellfish, that's where the biggest impact has been seen to date. So, I mean, that's not in the future. That's now oysters and mussels, and therefore the aquaculture industry. And then there are some organisms which won't be hit as hard. It's not clear what will happen to crab, for example, the crab fishery. They will be impacted by the oxygen issue you brought up, but directly by pH, we're trying to figure that out. There might be some winners as individuals, if you like. I mean, some of the algae or seagrass might do better, but the system is going to change. I think that's the thing, is that I sort of think of this almost like change management. If you have a corporation and some of your dominant players change in that corporation and your political regime, you want a smooth transition. And so that's, I think, should be our game plan here, is that we try and preclude some kind of ecosystem collapse, because that's really going to bite us as humans hardest.
Well, we talked with Congressman Huffman about the Ocean Acidification Innovation Act. There's also this thing called the Fishackathon. I don't know if either of you can speak to this. Emily Jeffers, I mean, they're saying calling all hackers. They want to invite coders and designers to collaborate on technology to make for more sustainable fishing. I mean, there are things that are really out there that seem really quite imaginative in trying to bring in new technology. I don't know if either of you want to comment.
Well, I think, you know, the more people that are involved in this problem, the better. We need creative ideas and creative thinkers. Ultimately, we need to prevent the sources of pollution that are causing the changes. But in the meantime, we need effective management strategies. We need more monitoring. We need smart people thinking about the issue. And frankly, not enough people are even aware that ocean acidification is a problem. So, you know, the more people working on it, the better.
And what about, John Largier, shifting, for example, to mitigation and adaptation solutions that would involve presumably estuary-based conservation? I mean, there's a lot of talk about storm water management and shellfish production as well, but also state and local officials doing marine conservation and doing water use planning.
Right. And just before answering that, just emphasizing what Emily said, the acidification of the oceans is a global issue, and there's only really one way to slow that down, which is to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But it is aggravated, enhanced, exacerbated, if you like, in near the coast where we might have runoff, what I'd call organic pollution.
Urban and agricultural runoff.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Wastewater, agricultural runoff, even nutrients which can stimulate algal blooms, because when that material decays, then again it creates the carbon dioxide, creates acidic conditions. So that is the one place where we really want to get rid of that kind of, to the extent that that's pollution that has been increased by humans. We want to get rid of that.
Well, it all affects the chemistry of the waters. Yeah.
It all affects the chemistry, and that's the one knob that we can turn, because it's something we can manage. And I think Emily talked about that quite clearly using Clean Water Act and other approaches. So that would be pretty useful.
Well, we're talking about human activity ultimately here. And I mean, it could make a great deal of difference. There's a study out of Stanford study in bioscience talked about coastal ocean upwelling and river runoff and all of those kinds of things that, again, affect the chemistry.
Right, yeah. So upwelling is you know, natural acidification, if you like, because we're drawing water out from the depths of the ocean where it's rich in carbon dioxide. And we cannot change that. But again, climate change is changing that. In the last 30 years, upwelling along our coast has increased, so we're getting colder water and more acidic water even before we've started accounting for the chemical changes. So there are a lot of things going on. And I think one of the, again, jumping back to the pollution issue, one of the key things here is to sort of de-stress as much as we can the ecosystem. So if you imagine an approaching flu epidemic, you'd want everybody to be healthy so they can be resilient and maybe survive it better. So you don't want to be stressing the ecosystem, and we're stressing the ecosystem in many other ways. And so that's probably one of the best things we can do here.
Preventive medicine, I think, is what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Emily Jeffers, what about affecting this on a legal global level? I mean, what can we do?
Well, I think Obama announced this week or last week reduced emissions. He said, I think, 30% reduction by 2030. It's a step, but it's not far enough. It's one of my colleagues said that it's like fighting a forest fire with a garden hose. I'm glad he turned on the water, but it's not really going to get the job done. If we are really serious about fighting carbon emissions and fighting ocean acidification and climate change, we need to do more.
Well, as I said earlier, the president did announce yesterday that there's going to be a vast expansion of the Pacific Ocean sanctuaries for marine life, and that certainly could help in terms of acidification. We'll hear more about that from Monica Medina, who is with the National Geographic Society. But in the meantime, we'd like to hear from you. If you have some thoughts about ocean acidification, about really the safety and preservation of the oceans, the effect on them of all of these chemical effects, job losses, habitat destruction, shellfish industry. I mean, there's a wide range of things that are at stake here. And we'd like to hear your thoughts, and we'd like to hear what you have to bring to the conversation here. Our toll-free number is available. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you can join us now. That number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone call, so feel free to be a part of the program. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. A number of other ways, of course, to communicate with us. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, and you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED. Forum. We spoke earlier with Jared Huffman, congressman from the 2nd District of California, talked with him about what he's co-sponsoring, the Ocean Acidification Innovation Act. Also talking this hour with John Largiere, who's here in studio, professor of the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at UC Davis, stationed in the Bodega Marine Laboratory, and Emily Jeffers, who is staff attorney in the Oceans Programs at the Center for Biological Diversity. And we also had an opportunity to speak with Terry Sawyer, co-owner of Hog Island Oyster Company. Many of you have a stake in this, and so you may indeed want to join us and let us know what your thoughts or feelings are. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're discussing ocean acidification and the health of marine habitats, the changing nature of the chemistry of our oceans and the health of marine habitats. And we're going to go to your calls and emails in just a moment here. I wanted to go first to a woman I mentioned before we went to the break, Monica Medina, who's with us by phone from Washington, D.C. She's Senior Director for Ocean Policy with the National Geographic Society. And we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Good to have you here. And I want to talk, first of all, if we could, with you about, well, President Obama's announcement, sanctuary areas, and what impact this can have potentially on ocean acidification.
Well, it's a tremendous announcement by the president yesterday, and we're so thrilled that he took this first step towards fully protecting a large swath of the Pacific Ocean that's under the U.S. control. And it would be a tremendous help to understanding the impacts of ocean acidification by creating these refuges, these places where we can study and learn and understand just what's happening in our oceans now and preserve them for future generations. So it's really so thrilling that the president did this. He hasn't used this power in the ocean in the past. He's done it many times on land, used his power under the Antiquities Act to set aside special places, and we're just poised and ready to help him finish designing the details and completing all the necessary legal steps to actually designate the area. But his intention to do it is a huge, huge step forward.
Yeah, he's probably going to get some blowback because this is executive authority, and there are those on the Hill who don't necessarily give that credence the way he does. But he did this, as you indicated, on a number of other occasions with 11 national monuments, and this is all slated for later this year. And just so listeners get a better understanding of this, because it is quite significant. It would make off-limit broad parts of the Central Pacific to fishing, to energy exploration, to all kinds of other activities. Isn't that right, Monica?
Yes, it does. This authority is something that lots of presidents have used of both parties. And in fact, the current the president's executive decision would build on the same authority used by President Bush to actually start creating these protected areas. President Bush, in 2009, just before he left office, actually started used the Antiquities Act to start the monument process and actually protect 50 miles out from seven small atolls in the very remote Pacific, atolls that the U.S. has controlled for decades, but no one lives there. So they're very, very remote. They're unusual biological hotspots, and President Bush recognized that and used this authority to create marine protected areas, no-take reserves around them going out 50 miles. But the U.S. has jurisdiction over 200 miles from the land in each of these islands, going out 200 miles, and Bush only protected up to 50. What President Obama is proposing to do is protect out to 200 miles.
Yeah, this could actually double the area of fully protected global ocean.
It multiplies it by 9 times. The current area is 200,000 square kilometers, and if President Obama takes this action and goes to the full extent of the U.S. exclusive zone, economic zone, it would be 1.8 million additional square miles for a total of over 2 million square miles, making it the largest protected area on Earth of any type. And it's probably something that could never be repeated again by any other country. It's a huge benefit to future generations of Americans, and it's a huge benefit to the Pacific Ocean, which really sorely needs areas like this where wildlife can be very much protected from the sort of wall of hooks of industrial tuna fishing fleets and from mining and oil and gas and other mineral exploration that can be so destructive.
Talking with Monica Medina from Washington, Senior Director for Ocean Policy with the National Geographic Society. Before I let you go, Monica Medina, could I just get your read on for our listeners on that ocean conference which was held at the State Department? It really, from what I read, showed how much impact we've been talking about that ocean acidification has had on shellfish farming and basic chemistry of the ocean.
It was a great opportunity to educate an awful lot of decision makers and people who are working in this field, and then the public, about the tremendous problem of ocean acidification. It's climate change's evil twin. It's the water impacts, you know, the global ocean impacts of climate change are real, and people can see them and they can measure them. And Secretary Kerry really put this issue on the map for the world.
There were a lot of global representatives there, as I understand.
There were 90 countries represented, and I'll tell you, at a time when I think the U.S. is trying to figure out how we can play a very constructive role in foreign policy around the world, one of the representatives from a small Pacific Island nation said to me, this is how the United States can make its, can use its power and its all of its resources to help other countries and to make itself a friend to all the world. And I was really struck by that, that the convening power of the United States and the Secretary of State knowing how to use that for good to help these countries deal with problems that they're going to be inundated by. Literally, I mean, between ocean acidification and sea level rise, small island countries in the Pacific are really, you know, needing help, and they need the kind of support and sort of the convening authority that Secretary Kerry used not only brings the U.S. support, but it brings support from all other parts of the world as well. And when we work together, there's an awful lot we can accomplish.
Monica Medina, again with us from the nation's capital, Senior Director for Ocean Policy with the National Geographic Society. We thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to be here today.
Glad to have you. We're going to go to your calls here. I want to get Emily Jeffers on for a moment, though. But I mean, certainly she's saying very supportive things about the administration, about Secretary Kerry, about all that's being done by the Obama administration. Do you share that perception?
I think every step that we take is a positive step, but I think we need to take many, many more. Creating these huge reserves will certainly lessen the stresses from overfishing and other challenges that the ocean's ecosystems are facing. But it doesn't really get to the source of carbon dioxide pollution and the reductions that we really need to make if we want to have any difference in ocean acidification.
Let's find out what our callers have to say, and we begin with Ian. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah. I'm a climate scientist, and we talk a lot about, because of the dire situation, potential applications of geoengineering, which would pretty rapidly change the temperature of the surface of the Earth. But the real sticking point in any of those discussions is, well, if we still can't reduce carbon dioxide, there's no kind of turnkey chemistry solution to the acidification of the ocean. And I was wondering if there's been any research into that or if there's any planned research into that.
Professor Largier, can you help us here?
Yeah, Ian, I think probably you appreciate the role of the ocean in slowing down climate change because it's like a big flywheel that slowly sucks up heat and carbon dioxide. And it's exactly the same thing at it's going to make any geoengineering approaches really, really difficult to try and treat the whole ocean, and it's probably not very wise in any case. So you're pointing to one of the key issues here. Although this is closely allied to climate change and driven by the same carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, all the geoengineering approaches to climate change are not going to help with this issue. So at this stage, there's nothing on the table, and frankly, I don't think we're going to be able to treat the oceans in any sort of grand scale. So hence the focus on local coastal areas where probably the biggest impact is, and there are these pollution things that we can engineer and improve on.
And let me thank you, Ian, for the call and go right to another caller, and that's you, Eric. You're on forum. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about an earlier guest had commented that the current ocean acidification levels were about 30 to 40%, I forget which, above pre-industrial times, and that they're slated to become up to 300 times, I think, by century's end. And he's already having trouble on the oyster farm and growing oysters at the current levels. I think about 1 billion people around the world depend on fish for protein, and the food chain is going to be disrupted with death of coral and plankton. So I'm wondering, business as usual energy policies, what kind of time frame are we looking at where humans may become a part of this current extinction event?
John, can you help us here? John Largier?
So the two things going on there, really, I guess the one is the reduction in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is a long-term game. There is no denying that. What we do now is going to take a while before the ocean particularly gets back into equilibrium. So there's the pessimism. And again, we are going to go through a change. And really, I think what we have to focus on again is to ease the transition. So we do not have a collapse of the productivity of the system, although we will have some winners and losers. And in terms of food, well, you're right. The here on the West Coast, we're talking about aquaculture and so on. The other big place is are the coral reefs in the tropical areas, where the water is less acidic than here, but the corals are way more sensitive. So while we have to work on the global problem, we also have to come up with some local adaptation both social, political, economic, as well as ecological.
And I thank Eric for the call. And on we go to Patrick next. Patrick, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Good morning. Thanks. I am just terrified by this problem. I mean, it just seems amazing. We are turning our oceans to acid. And so given that, I'm wondering why the EPA is not acting. Why are they not, as one of your guests said, using the Clean Water Act to fight this problem? What can we do to convince the EPA to get into gear and take this problem seriously?
Emily Jeffers.
Well, I think there are two reasons. One is states need better water quality data and monitoring, and there is not a lot of baseline conditions that we know of. So we need, in order to manage something, we need to measure it. That's the first step. Second, the Clean Water Act is an incredibly effective tool, but it hasn't yet been used in this fight. It's certainly applicable, but I think there's a certain amount of inertia in getting to an impaired waters listing, which is going to set a chain of events which will reduce pollution. But, you know, there's always a guinea pig, and one state is going to do it first. It just hasn't happened yet.
Are you also up against a kind of denial? I mean, not a kind of denial, but I mean, there's been a lot of naysaying where global warming is concerned up on Capitol Hill, and yet ocean acidification seems to be something that's very difficult to naysay.
I think it's impossible to naysay. The science is clear. The scientists are in consensus. It's a very clear chemical reaction that's happening, and there's no denying it. I don't think anyone is alleging that ocean acidification isn't happening or it isn't as dire a threat as we all know it is to be.
Here's Tom from Palo Alto, who says, too much talk of the impact of ocean acidification on humans and business, too many uses of the term seafood. The sea is not simply a source of food. The oceans control world climate. We're damaging that system. There are living creatures, many very ancient, that are being destroyed by our abuse of the ocean environment. Do we have no responsibility to care for the planet? Is everything only about our selfishness? And Nick in Fairfax writes, any thoughts about the possible diluting effect of melting glaciers on the future pH levels in the ocean? I recently read an article which stated that a 10-foot increase in sea level is now locked in no matter what we do. John Largier?
The melting glaciers, I think, at the global level are not going to dilute the problem at all. At a local level, they actually could maybe even aggravate it. Quite often, the freshwater inflows are more acidic than the ocean. But I don't know exactly the pH levels in those melting glaciers.
We'll bring another caller on, and that's Harvey. Good morning.
Hello, Michael. This is such an important show. And hello, Emily and John. Well, I'd like to, first of all, there's a billion cars doing two rush hours a day, all the buses, all the trucks on the planet, all the planes in the air, all the boats in the ocean, utility plants, farming, construction, machinery, recreational, military, home heating, industrial. We are putting it out. It's unbelievable. It seems to be our job almost is to change the atmosphere. But I have two suggestions. One is to replant America's urban, suburban, rural, and recreational national forests. They're suffering because of global baking. There's diseases moving around. There's all sorts of problems. And so I call on American people, and especially the youth, to replant the forests. The forests are the lungs of the earth. They turn the CO2 into oxygen. And secondly, once manufactured, solar panels produce no CO2 over their warranted 20-year lifetime. So I say it's time to get star-powered. Let's get solar to slow global baking.
Okay. Global baking. Thank you. Like the change in lexicon there to global baking. Say, John Largier.
Yeah, just a quick comment on the replanting the forests. Replant the ocean forests as well, if you like. I mean, that's both helps with the general problem, but also it helps with the local problem. If we can have more seagrasses in places where we used to have them and habitats like that, mangroves, etc., we've lost a lot of that. And that will definitely help mitigate coastal problems.
We still don't even know what's at the very deepest depths of the ocean, really, do we? In terms of what's growing there, for that matter.
We have an improving knowledge all along. You're right. But the majority of the ecosystem is up near the surface and along the coastline where the humans are and where we have this local impact in addition to the global impact, which is why we keep talking about that we can at least help mitigate some of the worst excesses.
But then when you talk about global mitigation, you have to bring in cooperation from other developing countries and all of that. We mm-hmm. always hit that when we talk about global warming or talk about the changes in the atmosphere. And I think Janice is right on that point here. Janice, welcome. You're on.
Thank you for taking my call. I just feel that until we get China to buy into this, we are fighting a battle that we can't win. They continue to use coal for their energy source, and all that does is put all that in the atmosphere, and then the favoring winds blow it over the Pacific Ocean. So I don't know how you get China on board.
Well, that gets into realms of international law and possibly other measures, diplomatic or otherwise. Emily Jeffers, given much thought to this?
Well, you know, there's no doubt that China plays a huge part in global emissions. But I think that the U.S. has to lead by example, and there's no way we're going to get China on board unless we show some leadership in this arena.
Doesn't necessarily leading by example doesn't necessarily mean they will follow, though.
It doesn't necessarily, but it's, you know, it's the best thing we can do. It's the only thing we can do.
Well, we can bring another caller on. And Hugh, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. It's not the only thing we can do. We can include these environmental measures in our international trade agreements. This has been in discussion since NAFTA. I remember a discussion at the Foreign Policy Institute in New York when Mexico made all kinds of promises. If it were just given time and no environmental restrictions inside NAFTA. And what will happen if you don't put them in the international trade agreements is that U.S. companies, which already have higher restrictions on air and water outputs, water out of factories in the U.S. is clean, will not buy into the agreements and they fall apart. So there's no reason that international environmental regulations cannot be put into international trade agreements, and countries that third world countries can be given a time to ramp up and can be given aid to do so. For example, in Indonesia, there is a program by the German government to help output from some factories, and that can be done with nonprofits and government aid alike to bring everybody up.
All right, let me get Hugh. I'm glad you brought this up. What about trade agreements and the sort of thing that he's talking about, Emily Jeffers?
Fully agree with the caller. I think that I didn't mean to imply that the United States could not influence global policy regarding carbon emissions solely by example. There are certainly things such as trade agreements that can be brought to bear on the problem.
Another listener named Miyoko emails us, John Largier, asking, what are some of the harms to coral reefs and reef fish from ocean acidification? What is being done to protect them?
So the the coral itself is what is most susceptible to ocean acidification, in that it is actually a hard substrate that is formed from the that is in equilibrium with the ocean water. And typically, the tropical waters are a higher pH, which means less acidic. So, but they are most susceptible in that way. In that case, it's the same story. Primarily, it's a global issue. The coral reefs are widespread. There are a few local areas where there will be pollution that can be managed, but there are many areas where the corals are not subject to that. But the corals are probably a good example of the multiple stresses that the oceans experiencing from climate change. We, you know, these coastal areas, the corals are subject to warming temperatures as well as to acidification. The reefs are subject to sea level rise, etc. So the idea of sort of band-aids locally will get us so far, but ultimately it comes back, as the callers keep pointing out, to the carbon dioxide, to the global issue, to getting some agreements, to getting ahead of this problem.
John Largier, again, is professor in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at UC Davis, stationed in the Bodega Marine Laboratory. Another question, John, for you from Stephen, who says, how does ocean acidification affect the available oxygen levels for humans and other species? You talked a little bit before about the oxygen effect, but, I mean,
right,
impact in terms of depletion or reduction? Or
yeah, so the impact of both acidification, ocean pH and ocean oxygen levels are not directly impacting humans. For example, when I swim in the ocean, acidic ocean, so-called, it's not really acidic in that way, but it definitely impacts the ecosystems and organisms that in turn will impact humans. So what I was trying to say early on is that the oxygen and the acidification are parallel issues. They tend to go in parallel rather than the one causing the other. And both of them, it's sort of Murphy's Law, both of them are going in the wrong direction with the climate change-related issues. So our upwelling waters here on the West Coast are becoming lower in oxygen and more acidic. So it's a double issue going on. And in actual fact, that's why this panel that is formed to serve California, Washington, Oregon, British Columbia that I sit on, the West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel, because hypoxia, low oxygen, is a parallel stress. And a lot of the things that bring about acidification locally also bring about hypoxia.
Well, we had Harvey, a caller before, saying, in effect, it was clear from his statements that maybe we should talk about global baking rather than global warming. And here's a listener who writes on Facebook, a listener named Michael. As a communications professional, we need to stop talking about acidification and call it what it is, pollution, plain and simple. This is the only way to have this issue gain traction with the American public. You've been nodding your head, Emily.
Sure. I think that, you know, not a lot of people know about ocean acidification. So if we had, maybe if we had a jazzier name.
Call it ocean pollution.
Well, that's sort of broad, but, yeah. You know, that encompasses a lot of things, plastics and toxic chemicals. But I'm open to suggestions for a new name to talk about ocean acidification.
The sour ocean.
There you go. We're open for more callers. And David from Napa joins us. Hi, David.
Yes, good morning. In conjunction with this acidification deal that's going on, I think we got to clear up one thing, and that's the misnomer of clean coal. There ain't no such animal. When we burn coal, the mercury vaporizes, goes up into the atmosphere, freezes over, re-liquefies. Mercury is the only liquid metal on our atomic chart, and drops back into the ocean. In conjunction with that, you want to know about oxygen. Well, when we start killing off this phytoplankton, I don't know what percentage it is, but it's probably 60, maybe 70% of the oxygen that comes back up to us comes from the phytoplankton. So I don't have any specific answers right now. But that clean coal misnomer has got to be cleared up to the American and the global public.
Yeah, clean coal may be another one of those oxymorons that deserved language change. Thank you, David, for your call. Let me get another caller on. That's Yule. Good morning. Oh, I'm sorry. It's Eric who's our next caller. Eric, hi. You're on.
Okay. What I was going to say is that I think it would be better on a countrywide basis, like our basis, to pursue the physical impediments to fish health and success, such as dams, rather than the secondary things that impede fish, like acidification. Let's focus on getting the dams down so that the salmon can thrive, rather than dealing with things that we can't deal with, like China and India's use of coal. And I'll take my answer off the phone, like on the air.
All right. Thank you, Emily Jeffers.
I sort of disagree with the caller in saying that ocean acidification is not directly impacting fish. There have been some really interesting studies out of Australia that show reef-dependent fish, like the clownfish, like Nemo, that when the ocean becomes more acidic, they, instead of swimming away from predators, they swim towards predators, and they can't go back to their home reef. And then for salmon, 60% of juvenile pink salmon's diet consists of pteropods, which are tiny creatures in the ocean, also called sea butterflies, and they're in decline in the California coast right now. So I think that we do, of course, need to address dams and other impediments to salmon, but ocean acidification is a real threat, and it's happening now.
Also, the caller's comments suggest that maybe there ought to be a different kind of triage. I mean, you know, in terms of what you want to emphasize vis-a-vis pragmatic notions of what you can do or accomplish.
Well, sure. I mean, we need to start locally and then move on to global emissions. And that's I think that everyone's in agreement with that.
We'll bring another caller on, and that's Yule. Good morning, Yule.
Hi, good morning, Michael and your crew. My reading has informed me that in addition to the ocean pH increase, agricultural nitrogen, fertilizer nitrogen runoff will be the next major ocean toxin. if this is true, how is this going to interact with the increase of with other pollution and of course the pH increase? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, John Larger.
Nutrient pollution is already an issue, and it's
we've actually talked about it on this program.
Yeah, yeah. It's particularly localized. You know, where the runoff enters the ocean, there are all sorts of problems with that. The nitrogen that enters the ocean is typically used so in the coastal areas, and I can't see it really becoming a global problem going into throughout the ocean, other than maybe in the deep ocean. But there the water is already nutrified. I mean, the deep ocean is like your compost heap, and that's part of this ocean acidification hypoxia deal, is that anything living in the surface of the ocean, where most things live, as they die, they sort of filter, float down slowly and decompose. So down below, let's say, 1,000 feet, you have lots and lots of nitrogen. You have lots of carbon dioxide, which is why the water that upwells is acidic. And you have very little oxygen, and that's changing, even less oxygen. So now we're getting low oxygen water upwelling as well. So I agree with you that it's a big issue, but it's an issue now, and I believe it'll always be dominantly an issue in the coastal ocean. Yep.
Well, we will continue to follow this story, and you can continue to make comments or continue to converse about it online, going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. I want to thank those who joined us this hour. We're joined by Congressman Jared Huffman, Emily Jeffers from the Center for Biological Diversity, UC Davis Professor John Langier, Monica Medina of the National Geographic Society, and Terry Sawyer, co-owner of the Hog Island Oyster Company. We thank our guests, and we thank you for being a part of this program. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening, and we wouldn't be here without you. So, again, our thanks. Another hour of Forum up ahead. In the hour ahead, we're going to talk about animal madness with local author Laurel Braitman, who's written a book under that title all about anxious dogs and compulsive parrots and elephants in recovery and how they help us understand ourselves. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.